Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Deitch, and each week we interview members of the sports media about their work and interesting people about the sports media. My producer, as always, is Bette Marston, and today's guest is Shelly Smith, the longtime ESPN reporter, now a bureau reporter in Los Angeles. Shelly's also worked prior at Sports Illustrated. She's been very public about her fight with breast cancer. I believe she's now in remission, which is great news. And we're going to hit on a lot of topics with Shelly about her the process of being public with breast cancer, her career, the fact that she was almost let go by ESPN in 2014, what it's like to be a 50-something woman, a woman in a business where there are not many 50-something women. And hopefully some other interesting things will come up. I'm really looking forward to speak with her. So without further ado, here's Shelly Smith of ESPN. Okay, as promised, we bring on Shelly Smith from ESPN. And Shelly, thank you very much for joining the Sports Illustrated podcast. I want to start with this. You announced via Twitter last October that you had been diagnosed with breast cancer, and you've been very public with that fight, I think inspired a lot of people. How is your health at the moment?
Right now, I am proud to say I am cancer-free. Now, there are no guarantees. You're never really out of the woods once you have cancer, but I do know that I've done everything in my power. I did chemo, I did radiation, I've done everything I possibly can and surgery to stay cancer-free. I guess when you hit the five-year mark, that's sort of the milestone. But when I rang that bell at the end of radiation, you ring it three times, and I said, you know, I'm done. I am done with cancer.
Shelly, how staggering was hearing that diagnosis when you heard it?
Well, it was awful. As I think I told you, my doctor, who I now refer to as Quack A, in the middle of telling me that they found what he said was likely cancer on my mammogram, he wanted to know what pick the Lakers got. And I was like, I'm a little, you know, preoccupied right now. But that's what happens when you're in sports and your doctor is a sports fan. And he's done so many great things for me, like I'm on the road and I need something. He just calls it in. So try not to hold that against him, but it was staggering. It was terrifying. It was shocking, and it stayed that way until actually a year ago right now. I remember going to the ESPYs last July 16th, finally with a plan. From May to July, I was searching for answers, for doctors, for second opinions. I went up to Stanford. I had more pokes and prods than you can even imagine. And finally had a plan, and I remember taking my first Arimidex, which is an estrogen inhibitor, because my cancer is estrogen positive. And so the plan was to take a pill for 6 months and shrink the tumors and then have surgery. Surgery would be less invasive. Once I had a plan, the terror stopped. The scare ended. I was uncertain how I was going to get through till surgery, which would be in January, because I'm the kind of person that I want to do it right now. I was ready. I'm going to have surgery. I want to get it done. I want it over. But my doctor said to me, you know, it's going to be a marathon. And it was. It's been exactly a year since I started treatment. And I will be on Arimidex for the next 10 years, so which is a good thing. I feel really fortunate to be able to take something to keep further enhance my chances of the cancer not coming back.
Shelly, one of the things that was always impressive in terms of just even following you on social media and seeing you comment was just how upbeat you were. And you talked about just how you drew strength from other people contacting you, letters, Twitter messages. My guess is that's not always the case. I think some people approach the cancer, you know, they fight it, they stay upbeat.
Being nice to me.
Well, yeah, that's sometimes ironic in itself. But I wonder, what is that just your personality, or did you have to come to the point where just psychologically you came to a place where you were going to be as upbeat as possible to beat this thing?
I just, when I decided to announce, it was because a friend of mine was also going through cancer, and I'd already done the interview with Robin Roberts at the ESPYs last year, and I didn't know that they were going to run it, and they ran it, and I was like, well, I better say something, because Robin and I are talking about my cancer, and how she was shocked to find out about me, so that was part of the reason. I also said to my daughter the night before, oh, I might as well. Nobody's going to pay attention anyway. You know, I really had no idea it would become so big. But once I realized how many people I was touching and affecting, and I realized that maybe we can accomplish something through this, I was still scared of chemotherapy. And I'm always positive. I really am. And my daughter drives me crazy because she's so moody. And I'm like, why can't you be positive? But I am. But when, Stuart was very private. Stuart Scott was very private about his. And then Brian Burwell got melanoma and was very private about his. So I understand people are different. But I had a plan. I had a winnable fight, I believe. And if I didn't have a winnable fight, I may have been more private. I don't know. I just don't know. But I just had a lot of confidence that I was going to beat this. And I thought, if I can, you know, get one person to go get a mammogram who, unlike me, you know, I blew it off. I absolutely blew it off because, and I gave a talk at our meeting this last week, because we all want to work. We all want the big story. We never want to say no. When the bosses call for you to do something, you want to say yes and you want to go because we love it. It's what we do. But I did it to the detriment of my health. I haven't had a mammogram. I didn't have one for 2 years. And they would have, I hope, would have caught it earlier. It's not wasn't a fast growing tumor. But if I could get one person, you know, or two people or hundreds or thousands to just think about it, then I thought being positive and being public, it's the right way to do it. And then when both Brian and Stuart died, my fear of anything, the fear of chemo, went away. I just thought those guys would love this fight. They would love the chance to have chemo again. They would love the chance to fight, and that really took all of my trepidation about going into the chemo room and them, you know, putting the needle in my hand and giving me 4 hours of drugs that would, you know, you can look at it as poison or you can look at it as something that's saving your life. And I think I told you, an oncology nurse told me, when you lose your hair, it means the chemo is working, and that also changed my whole attitude on things. I'm like, bring it on, you know, bring it on. And I talked to people in that chemo room and the people who were fighting other things. And once they heard that, you know, because they were like, I'm so sick, I've got infections. I go, well, it's the medicine, you know, it's working. And so it just became me. And I don't know if it would have been different, like I said, if I didn't think I had a winnable fight, but that it just became me. And it was a traumatic experience. I had a lot of infections. I got the flu twice. I had lymph nodes. There was one day I went into my doctor crying, saying I suck because I had a port in one arm and I had an armpit stuffed with gauze in the other, and my hair was gone, and I had the flu. And I just said, and then, you know, this is another thing doctors do when you're in sports, and you probably experience the same thing. They think they have to talk in sports metaphors.
Right.
So he says, it's just like throwing an interception in the first quarter of the Super Bowl. I said, okay, all right, you feel like you need to do that to get me to understand. But it just became me, and talking about it and being positive became me. And I'm not stopping either. I'm going to continue to be positive and continue to sing the praises of early detection and self-examination and awareness of your body. So it's part of me now.
When you returned to ESPN's airwaves on April 30th, you were bald. And this was a pretty cool statement to me, because you were sort of acknowledging to the audience that, hey, yeah, I have breast cancer, ask questions. What do you want to know about this disease? Did you have to think about, not that you were not going to do it, but was there any part of the process of appearing on the air bald in such a business where appearance does, you know, is part of what you are and who and what you do?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I from the very beginning, when he told me I was going to lose my hair, I said, you know what I do, right? I work in television. And he said, yeah, I know. He goes, it'll grow back. And I said, yeah, but not right away. It's going to take a while. And it did concern me, and I did get a wig, and I put it on. I wore it home. I went to the grocery store. Everyone's, oh, you look fabulous. I'm like, it's a wig. It just, it wasn't me. It was fake. And I couldn't do it. And I'd already appeared on Twitter with my head getting shaved. But I also at the beginning thought, well, I'm going to have to wear a wig because I don't want to scare people. I don't want to scare little kids, for example, who are watching SportsCenter. And so that's why I went ahead and got the wig. And then I thought, well, wait a minute. I have nothing to be ashamed of. Why is there a stigma against people going through treatment? We're blessed to be able to go through treatment. And then I thought also, what about women who are in the fight who can't afford wigs? They're not cheap. So I thought about a lot of that. You know, what about women? I found out that women don't want to have mammograms because they don't want to know. And that really saddened me. So that's why we started to raise money for the National Breast Cancer Association, which provides for women now. And I said, well, what do you do if a woman finds out she has it and she has no money and she has no insurance and she's got a 9-to-5 job and 3 kids at home? And they said, well, we have grants at hospitals and we find people. And they're in the Dallas area, but they're nationwide. And that heartened me. I also saw that there were mobile mammograms all over the inner city in L.A. because I went to a walk in Compton. But they also said women don't want to know because they can't take off work. They can't afford health care. They can't, you know, but I want to say to anybody listening to that, there are ways to do it. There are grants out there. There are people out there. And so don't be afraid to find out. But to answer your question, yeah, I finally, you know, never was discussed with ESPN. I asked the stylist, Barrett Nash, who's awesome. I said, what do you think? She goes, I don't think you should hide it. And I said, I don't want to hide it. I said, I don't think I can wear that wig. And then I asked my doctor, my oncologist, and he said, I think it would really empower a lot of women out there. And he said, you know, a lot of women are choosing not to get wigs, but a lot of women are afraid to go out without a wig or some sort of head wrap. And the only time I wore a head wrap was when my head got cold. But that gave me a lot of encouragement too. And then when I got down to it, it was easy. It was just, like I said, it became me. And that's who I was. And I was proud that I had a fight and proud to show whoever was watching that it's okay to go bald, to be in the fight. You should feel lucky. And I hope that came across. But I also didn't want people to miss the message of what I was saying. Not that what I was saying was, you know, earth-shattering. It was Marcus Mariota is going to be drafted.
Right.
But I had hoped then that if people didn't know, they would go to Google and find out, and they did. And even today, I find people tweeting saying, I didn't know. I hadn't seen you, and then I saw you. And, you know, it was all kinds of different reactions. Now that my hair is growing back, too, all kinds of different reactions. But it just became an easy decision after a while.
I appreciate you answering that. One of the things that people who listen to this podcast seem to really like is a description, a very specific description of the jobs that the guests do and the process of which they go through. So you are a bureau reporter for ESPN in Los Angeles, which means you could get an infinite number of different stories that come up on a daily or weekly basis. So as specific as you can you tell the listeners what your job is on either a daily or a weekly basis?
I listened to Carissa's last night because I wanted to sort of see, and I love her, but I don't go to hair and makeup twice a day. That doesn't happen, even when I had hair. My job is so different, and I do love her, and she's got the most wonderful sense of humor. I remember the first time I met her, I walked into the makeup room, and she goes, look, I got extensions, and she just lifted up her hair and showed me the extensions, and I was like, great. Why I love my job, there is no typical day. Every day is different. Every morning I get up and find something different to do, to work on. I tend to work on 3 or 4 projects at a time. Today I'm actually compiling a list of college football SIDs and what days who speaks when. Like USC, the offense speaks Tuesday and the defense speaks Wednesday because we need a list. And so that's what I'm doing right now when you call. And then I'm going to a benefit tonight for Baron Davis. So I'm doing that. All right. And then tomorrow is the ESPYs, and I'm going early and working the red carpet and helping a young man named Donovan Hill, who was featured in our OTL 25th anniversary, who broke his neck playing Pop Warner football. So I am meeting his mom and him at the red carpet and taking them and introducing them to people with the hopes that some player with the foundation will adopt him, basically, and get him some help. So that's different. I'm working on several stories that will air later in the month, you know, trying to figure out who we're going to interview. Research always. Read everything. First thing I do in the morning is read. Just read everything that's out there. The AP, the Washington Post, Sports Illustrated. I'll just throw that in there, Richard, for you.
Thank you.
Sweet. You're welcome. And just try to educate myself. And it's kind of hard to get back in the swing because for 4 months, all I did was get up, go to treatment, come home, and then I watched all seven seasons of The West Wing. So that's all I did for 4 months. I just kind of took off from the sports world, from any world, and just kind of took care of myself, respected the process, and learned. And The West Wing is so well written. I learned a lot there, too. So now getting back in the swing of things, it's funny. I find that I don't remember things like I used to. I don't know if it's the chemo or it's because I didn't do anything with my mind, really, for 4 months. So I spend a lot of time planning, and I'm getting ready for college football. I'll do sidelines again. They throw me on, I'm not with a specific team, they throw me on whatever game might need a sideline reporter. I like that better than, you know, although I like the camaraderie you can develop with a team with the play-by-play and the analyst. But I also like when there's a news value to be at a game. It makes it a better experience because you're not trying to justify your existence. You're already justified because I'm there. You know, it's like if somebody's about to get fired or there's been a kid kicked off the team or something. You know, there's always some drama going on somewhere. So I'm getting ready for that. I'm trying to refresh my memory with all the, you know, who's coaching where, who's got the top 50 players. I make lists. I hate being bored, so we're also working on with my daughter, my very bossy daughter, who's now the producer, lead producer on our 30 for 30 documentary that Keyshawn Johnson's producing. We're finishing that up. It has to be done by September 11th. So, you know, just have my hand on it. I saw somebody put on Twitter want to know if I was still writing the Al Davis book. I am. I will be writing it probably forever. Because people want to read about him, but nobody wants to talk about him. So that's really hard.
Pardon me? I was going to say, so let's sort of focus on those two things, because that's interesting. So one, is this the 30 for 30 on the 2006 BCS National Championship between Texas and USC?
Yes.
Wow.
And it's been really, really fun to go back and revisit that game, even as painful as it is for USC fans and as exhilarating it is for Texas to, you know, throw it back in their faces. It's really, really been fun. And we've interviewed everybody from Matthew McConaughey to Snoop. We've had Lindale. Lindale, wait till you see Lindale. He just is awesome. He's so honest. You should have him on your podcast.
He would be good.
Lindale White. He's just so honest and is really great in this. And so we're putting Aaron Thomas is the producer. He did Friday Night Light, director. He did Friday Night Lights the first season and won a bunch of Emmys, and he's fabulous and brilliant. And, you know, we're getting that done. It's been a two-year process so far. It's really hard to do those. And there's not a lot of money, so you're crunching numbers all the time.
Is there a prospective air date yet for that?
Right after the Heisman ceremony.
Oh,
in
wow.
November. Or is it November or December? I don't know. Whatever.
I think early
minutes. Really good time slot. We were really happy about that.
Oh, that's great. And the other thing is there's an ongoing Al Davis biography basically being? Okay.
Yeah, I started that, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, and it was in conjunction with ESPN Books, which, as you know, kind of folded. We had an agreement with, I think it was Random House, I don't know. So it kind of went away, and then Al died, and so then I had to change all that he is, that he was, and go after people who wouldn't talk to me while he was alive. And still a lot of people don't want to talk. I think they're afraid of the ghosts of Al, you know, but there's so many great stories out there and so much I want to tell. And I really thought during chemo I would pick it back up just pick up and, you know, pick up where I left off, and then I was really sick. So I will get it done. I just don't know when.
Is there a...
It's funny, like...
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, it's like John Gruden. I said to him, I'm writing a book on Al Davis, and he said, I want to read that. I said, no. I need you to be in it. But people were really afraid at that time, so I'm going back at them.
I like that. For the almost close to now 20 years that you've worked at ESPN, and obviously prior to that you worked at Sports Illustrated, Pacific Stars and Stripes in Tokyo, some other stops. Is there what for you is the most memorable story you've ever worked on?
Oh, my gosh, there's so many. You know, we had to write remembrances of OTL stories, and I picked the last two I worked on, and I forgot about the one I did with the three pedophiles in prison who were coaches, who became coaches to find victims. That was pretty memorable. You know, Manti Te'o was fun. But, you know, always in my heart, the biggest story will be the Ben Johnson story. And it's funny, I speak to classes. They have no idea who Ben Johnson is. That was so long ago, the 88 Olympics. But that was my big break. I was with Sports Illustrated, and my beat was drug control. So I went over and I met, and that's where I learned that preparation is so key. I spent days over there meeting people, and this is before cell phones and anything, and I got lab numbers, and I got home numbers, and I was really prepared. So when that story hit, I was immediately able to find out that it was the middle of the night. We had just put the magazine to bed. This was back in the days when, you know, you put it to bed Monday nights, and I forget the Korea time difference, but we were all out celebrating, and then we get the call that he had tested positive, and so I was able to call the sources I had developed and find out that he was already headed to the airport. So I jumped in a cab and headed to the airport too, and I didn't have a passport with me. I didn't have money. Oh, I had some money, but I didn't have any lipsticks. That was a big concern. And then bought a ticket to Tokyo because we thought that was the first flight out, and we heard there was a Ben Johnson on the flight. Got on the flight, actually found out that the Ben Johnson was a white clothing salesman from Toronto, I think, also, and got off the flight, and then they were immediately curious what I was doing. By this time, we had a photographer came with my passport, or I guess it was before because I had to buy a ticket, John Iacono, and we found the next flight was to New York, and so we ran down the hallway, the gateway to the gate, and bought two tickets at the gate, and as we see 100 Canadian Mounties coming with Ben Johnson, escorting him to the plane, and we have walkie-talkies by this point. And I'm like, I got him, what do you want me to do? And they go, get on that flight. So, and radio in quotes if you can. And I did, and we got on the flight, and I got him when we were literally in the upper level, and so as soon as he got to go to the bathroom, I just swooped down and got him, and got him for about 45 minutes, and he lied the whole way through, as we would find out when we landed. But landed, it was the greatest feeling in the world walking off that plane on the tarmac. Again, it was very different times. There was hundreds of cameras and reporters waiting for him, and they got him out the back way. But to walk through them, knowing I had the story, went right into the SI offices and on my electric typewriter, typed up my notes, and we got him in Time Magazine for the next week where you see him on the cover. And I'll never forget that. You know, it was a big break. It was a big story. And I really remember thinking, I will never top this. And I don't think I have. I think I've gotten close. But that's what my love of breaking news came. And that's what I still love to do best. If you ask me, you know, what you want, I love the chase. I love I love investigating. But I love the fast pace of breaking news. And that will never change, I don't think.
That's a great story. I want to ask you a couple questions about the business, and this is something that you spoke.
About what?
I want to ask you a couple questions about the business, and this is something that you spoke with me on when we last talked. Remarkably, ESPN nearly did not re-sign you last year,
right.
And you said you were told by management that you needed to get better at live shots in order to continue
right.
on. Was that fair criticism for management?
Well, I wasn't consistent. I wasn't consistently bad. I wasn't consistently good. I think what happened was I had a complete meltdown in San Francisco, and it just absolutely freaked me out, and I couldn't recover. And it was like all Jim Harbaugh, I called him Jim McMahon. And I knew I'd said something wrong, and I couldn't think of what I'd wrong, because my producer jumped up, you know, hoping I could correct it, and I couldn't. I just freaked out, and it was the worst live shot I've ever done. And my boss called me right after and said, "Are you okay?" And I'm like, that didn't help, because I was hoping nobody saw it. But I wasn't ever comfortable after that. I just freaked out, and I got so much feedback from people. You know, you're moving too much, you talk too fast, you know, and I just was hearing so much that I wasn't really surprised, because we started to do so many more live shots. They called me into the office and told me this, and I was really worried that they weren't going to give me a chance to get better. I thought they just wanted to get rid of me. But I got Lori Orlando on the phone, and she said, "No, we want to send you to Dallas. We want you to work with these people, talent coaches. We want you. We want you to stay. We want to give you every chance we can so that you can convince management that, you know, we love everything else about you." So I went to Dallas. I worked with these people. And basically, they just told me, loosen up, be yourself. Don't be afraid to move around. Movement's fine. You know, gesture, be funny, use your personality. And that, like, unlocked a key. And I immediately got better. And I think the difference, or what changed their minds, came in December during the Florida State Jameis Winston. And then I did some NFL. And, I mean, I worked so hard. I worked every holiday. I was in Green Bay Christmas Eve, you know, doing live shots from there to prove to them that I could do this. And finally, they were able to show, my immediate bosses were really fighting for me. I just found that out last week. So management, the ones who were pushing back, the difference. And I did make a difference, and I did get better, and I needed to get better. And I was so proud when finally Rob King emailed me and said, you know, get ready for a new experience. I have a new idea on things. And that was so gratifying, because I really worked hard, and I felt relief for 2 months, and then I found out I had breast cancer, and I thought, well, what kind of year is this? You know, bring it on. I can. And everyone said, you're the ultimate survivor, and I said, yes, I am. And it's embarrassing to say this, but the job situation was scarier than the cancer. It really was. It was, you know, the cancer, you fight, you have a plan. You never really know, and the job thing, it's so subjective. But I've survived both. How about that? That was quite a year. Quite a year.
For listeners' purposes, Rob King is the head of SportsCenter, someone who, through my reporting, I can tell you was an absolute champion for Shelly Smith, and to retain Shelly Smith when there were others in management who quite frankly, did not want to retain her at a certain point. Shelly, this leads me to another question on this, and again, I really appreciate your honesty, but I think this is important for people to hear. The business of sports television is filled with a lot of women in their 20s and 30s, but rarely in their 50s. That is not the case for men, and that is where the ultimate one of the ultimate biases lie. Men are allowed to age in the business. Men are allowed to age with looks in the business. This does not happen with women. So, and I'm not trying to get you to crack on ESPN, but I do want to ask you, in all this evaluation, how much of your age played a factor versus if you were doing the same kind of live shots but you were 26 years old?
I think my age helped. Well, not my age, but my experience. I think ESPN really values experience, and yes, it hasn't always been that way. You know, I know there are women out there gunning for my job, and I'm like, go for it. You know, learn how to do my job. You know, but I think they value experience, and I certainly know what I'm doing in different situations. They said at one point, we can put you on anything, and I said, yeah, because I've been doing this for so long, and I think actually that helped save me. Rather than, I don't think my age hurt me. I don't think, you know, the wrinkles and certainly being bald, but I think it only helped me. It helped give them a reason, a justification to keep me, because I am, I don't mean this arrogantly, but I'm good at what I do. I work really hard at what I do. I break stories. I get information. I come up with story ideas. I have great sources. And most of all, I'm a team player. If somebody comes to me and says, can you get me, you know, something from Steve Sarkisian. You know, I'll do it because I believe in the greater good, and that sounds kind of hokey, but serving our viewers. But I also believe in helping one another, and I know not everybody believes in that either. You know, people are very competitive and very secretive and very selective on who they tell what to, and that's fine. I'm not that way. I mean, I'll keep a source and a secret better than anyone, but if I can help someone with my information, I'm more than willing to do it. And I think that helped as well, because they knew, I think they considered me enough of an asset that if I just fix this one thing, that I would be retained. And I was, and I think I will be. I don't see that changing because I still have a passion for what I do, and I'm willing to do things like compile this list of college football SIDs and availability dates, you know, do things like that.
Right.
Because it will help us, yeah.
I will say this, and I agree with you. I think in the landscape of the business, I think ESPN, generally speaking, has been very good about making decisions based on value and merit as opposed to aesthetics. Uh-huh. I will say this, though, and I would like you to comment on this. The business as a whole, though, is not great. And again, you look at the larger landscape of sports television, and you know, seeing a woman, generally speaking, over 50, it can be like Haley's Comet sometimes. Yes, there's Doris Burke. Yes, there's Shelley Smith. Leslie Visser was on the air for a long time. And, you know, I get people on Twitter saying, you know, they name the 50-something people. That's great. There's 150 men who fit that same description over 60. So why is that the case, you think, Shelley? It's 2015. Why are some sports television executives still not comfortable putting women over 50 on the air?
Well, I think – I didn't know Doris was over 50. Man, she looks great.
I apologize if she's not. She's probably like 45.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's all – I know what you mean, middle-aged women. I think it's great that we have me. I think it's great. You know, 20 years ago, we wouldn't have had me or Doris or Leslie or anybody else who's out there of our age. And so I think there has been progress. It's not leaps and bounds, but I think I'm living proof that there has been change and that it's not just a men's group. I mean, there are a lot of men, but you look around, not just sports television, but news television. You look at 60 Minutes. You know, those women are middle-aged as well, and I think there is a new appreciation for experience, and I think that things have changed. I think ESPN has been ahead of the game in doing that, and I think we'll see. We were talking about this at the meetings last week. You know, they are looking for the new. Who will be the next bureau reporters? Because they know we're not going to last forever. I'm certainly not going to be doing this job for 20 more years. So they need to groom people, but they realize people are not, they don't have what we have. I looked at that in that bureau room, and we've all kind of grown up together, and we're all about the same age. Sal, Mark Schwartz, and, you know, certainly there was Britt McHenry and Josina, who are the youngsters in the group, but we grew up together, and we have things that they value, and I think it's going to take a while, and I think they're smart to start looking to see who the next bureau reporters are going to be. But yes, the business is changing. The money is a certain concern, especially the ESPN, and I know that we have to make cuts, and so where do you cut? I don't know.
And I will point.
Hopefully not me.
Well, let's hope. knock on wood. Doris Burke, by the way, is 50, and as I've written many, many times,
congratulations.
Yeah, one of the 10, easily one of the 10 best talents at ESPN, and you make the argument that maybe the best sideline reporter in the history of the medium.
And that comes from, you know, she played and she's experienced.
Correct.
And she knows how, and I think, you know, them not putting some young, not that there's anything wrong with young girls, but, you know, valuing her experience, I think, is a great tribute to ESPN.
I agree. It only took ESPN 6 years after I wrote it to get on board, but congratulations to management for that.
Well, see, you've always been at the forefront of things.
Yes.
So
all right. So let me ask you, Shelley, about Britt McHenry. And I think this was pretty cool when I found this out. After the release of the videotape showing her berating a tow truck worker, and I'm not going to ask you to comment on her actions. Everybody's seen it. They're indefensible. They're pretty deplorable.
Right.
That's not my point.
Yeah.
The point is you reached out to her when I think a lot of people, probably your company, wanted a persona non grata her. But you made it a point, and you told me this, that you wanted, if nothing else, just to sort of let her know that, hey, you're out there to talk to. Why did you make that decision to do that?
Because I knew she was hurting, and I knew we've all been there. We've all done things and lashed out and said really heinous things that weren't caught on tape. And even though she knew she was being taped, I just knew she was hurting. And I got a lot of heat for that. You know, I went to the Sports Emmys shortly after your article ran, and a lot of people came up to me and wanted to know why in the world I would reach out to her. And some of the people who came up to me have been the meanest people in this business. And I'm not going to name names. You can probably figure it out. But I was thinking, you of all people are chastising me for reaching out to a young girl who made a really horrible mistake. And I couldn't believe it. And I just said, look, she's a young girl. She's hurting. When I called her, she was just sobbing. She said, I feel like I let you all down. And I said, well, you know what? You did. I didn't sugarcoat it. I said, you did let us down. We expect more. I said, but we also understand people make mistakes. And I said, and you'll be tomorrow's news soon. And she has really rebounded well from it. I got up at the dinner that we had at the Bureau Dinner, which is sort of like the Washington Correspondents Dinner. And we all make fun of each other. I made fun of Sal because we were celebrating his 20 years. And then at one point, I thanked all the producers. And I said, okay, can we make fun of Brett yet? And, you know, everybody laughed. And here's the joke. She's taking things well. It hasn't affected her. We were worried. She was worried that it would affect her with athletes and teams because they were as offended as anybody.
Right.
A lot of them. Or fans. You know, fans can be so brutal, like on the sidelines. But she has really, and this is from talking to producers she's worked with too, really handles herself well and rebounded well. And she's a good reporter. And as I said, she's one of us, and we stick up for one another, or we should. And there's far too much catfighting in this business, and even men, you know, ripping on women who, because everyone's afraid of losing their job, you know. So there's always just competition and trying to put down someone else. There's too much of that. And I heard Carissa say this too. There's plenty of work out there, and I believe that. I don't think that will change. It may change the way you view or way you get ESPN. You're going to get it on your phone or your tablet, or you're going to, and you know, that's all going to change. And it's up to us to figure out how to change with it. But I believe that we will all have plenty of work for a good time to come.
All right, I got two more for you, Shelley. Final two. First off, have you ever thought about teaching? Because it strikes me as that I think you'd really be an excellent broadcast journalism teacher.
I have. In fact, I spent last year, the first part of, before I was, everything's like before diagnosis and after diagnosis, January to May or March at my alma mater, Nebraska, and I taught sports journalism. It was, they're trying to beef up their sports journalism program.
Nice.
And so I went from class to class and tried to, you know, basically I walked around and just told stories, you know, how you got the story. I think everyone wants to know, how did you get the story? How did you get the job? You know, so I spent a lot of time doing that. Teaching is exhausting. It was the most exhausting experience. I thought, oh my gosh, these teachers, they are never paid enough. They have to come and you have to bring it every single day. These kids are so hungry and they want to know. So I have thought about it, and I may. My schedule now wouldn't permit it because I really am like the breaking news. Like, how fast can you get to Cleveland? And so I wouldn't be able to commit to a class. But I have thought about it. I may.
I hope you do down the road. I think you'll find it fulfilling. All right, the last one, and I put it out there on Twitter for people to ask you some questions. So I took one random Twitter question. You have – Shelley Smith has 5 open seats to join her at dinner. Who would she ask to join her and why?
I saw that, and I was up all night thinking about that. I really –
Don't stay up all night thinking of these podcast questions, Shelley.
No, I don't sleep much anyway. So I wake up and I thought, oh God, what am I going to say?
Well, John Skipper should be one. So how about that?
Okay, John Skipper, Wild Hack. I would pick Stewart and Brian Burwell, and two scientist who could cure cancer.
Wow,
right, nice answer. And then myself. I miss those two guys every day, and I would like to meet the people who are working on finding a cure. I don't know who they are, but that's who I would fill the rest of the seats with, and see if we could go back in time and we could you know, get them through cancer like I'm getting through cancer.
Those scientists, those scientists are out there, and we wish them well, and we wish them soon to find a cure. All right, the guest has been the ESPN Los Angeles bureau reporter, Shelley Smith. Shelley, as you know, has pretty much covered every sport imaginable for ESPN, was a longtime Sports Illustrated writer, one of the most respected people in the business, now put cancer survivor on her resume as well, and I think that that's the best news of all. Shelley, I wanted you to have you on the podcast ever since I started this, so I really appreciate you joining us, and of course continued.
So glad you're doing them.
Yeah,
it's really fun to listen. I plan to listen to the others, but I love Carissa.
She was good. She
when
was.
I grew up and talk. I'm hour and 15. I was like, wow.
Yeah, Chris. That's partly my fault. Carissa. Chris went long, but no. Shelley, continued health. Continue the best
Richard.
Of health.
I really appreciate you.
You got it. Thanks, Shelley.
Great awareness. All right.
You got it. Take care. See ya. Okay, back in the studio. Our thanks to Shelley Smith. I really appreciate her honesty when it comes to her fight with breast cancer. It was really interesting to me just how, you know, she sort of was honest about what was going on with ESPN and the fact that she, you know, she had to get better on stand-ups. To me, that's kind of BS. I always think that stuff is subjective. And, you know, to me, it's about the content. And Shelley Smith's content has always been on point. I also thought it was really interesting that she talked about her relationship with Britt McHenry after her incident and that Shelley reached out to her. But Bette, as we bring Bette Marston in, you can't not but like Shelley Smith. She's authentic and honest, and ultimately that's, I think, what you want out of any guest.
Yeah, she was very open about her whole battle with this. And it was very impressive to me about how she wanted to get right back into her work. She, you know, as soon as she was ready, as soon as she passed, because she didn't, yeah, she was a person who's on TV, but she didn't sit around and wait for her hair to grow back. She hopped right back in, and I think that's one of the most admirable things about her. I also found it very interesting that she was talking about how she was doing a lot of research, how she'd be, you know, doing research for several days on time for a certain package. That's something in the journalism industry that kind of goes
under the radar.
Yeah, kind of unspoken almost. Like, I think a lot of viewers just assume that either someone has given them all this information, or these reporters, like someone has fed all these reporters all the information. No, it's up to them to go out and figure out who to interview and what to ask them about and how to ask the right questions. And I found that to be very interesting, and few people talk about it. So I'm glad that she brought it up.
Yeah, and her, you know, when she told the story about Ben Johnson, that sort of tells you like the core of Shelley Smith. She's always sort of been a reporter and an investigative reporter at heart, and she's still doing that today. You know, she'll do the legwork for people even if it's not her story. All right, we thank Shelley Smith. Next week's guest as of now is Bomani Jones of ESPN, who I'm really looking forward to. Interesting guy, works on both radio as well as television on Highly Questionable. So that should be good, and that is next week's interview. All right, wrapping up for Bette Marston, I'm Richard Deitch. We'll see you next time on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network, the number one daily sports podcast network? Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.